Good afternoon, you are tuned to Juno Afternoon here for Tuesday, the 16th of February, the year 2016. Today on the show, we'll get an update on childcare issues with guests Jerry Lyon, Margaret Bauer, and Lisa Earhart. Scott Byrne and Saul Neely will be here with an update on the Flying University Forum. We'll also get an update on library activities with Beth Weigel, and guest in our school principal Brenda Edwards and artist in the school Marianne Manning will be here to talk about the school-wide glass mosaic project underway at the school. That Writer's Almanac, Burnout, Music and More today on a Juno Afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, cloudy skies with patchy fog, scattered snow showers, low temperatures around 30 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Canadian government has wrapped up cross-country consultations on how to best conduct a national investigation into missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the Minister of Indigenous Affairs says the size of the tragedy is far greater than first believed.
The minister, Carolyn Bennett, says the number of missing and murdered Indigenous women across the country is way bigger than 1,200. A police report in 2014 put the number at 1,181 between 1980 and 2012. But Bennett says that does not even paint a complete picture of the magnitude of the problem. Bennett has been traveling across the country meeting with families of victims. She says she hopes the government will be able to develop a mandate for the inquiry within a few months.
We want to make sure that we make this culturally safe and involving of the families, involving the elders, that this has to be a process that Indigenous people feel comfortable participating in.
One of the key issues to be considered is the selection of one or more commissioners to lead the inquiry. The investigation must also be at arm's length from the government once it is underway. The inquiry must also determine whether some cases need to be reopened, and it must consider the survivors. Many families say they want to continue to be involved once the inquiry has begun. Bennett says from what she's heard so far in consultations and what will be among the most challenging aspects of the inquiry has been hearing about how hopeful people are about the process. One Native leader says families want justice and healing and want their voices to be heard. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development recently awarded $55 million in Indian Community Development Block grants. As KGOU's Brian Hardzinski reports, 16 Oklahoma tribes are set to receive part of the funds for housing, infrastructure, and other construction projects.
Most of the tribes received about $800,000. The Cherokee Nation will use its grant to rehabilitate approximately 40 housing units for the elderly and handicapped individuals. There are about 120 applicants currently on the waiting list. The Chickasaw Nation will spend $800,000 to build an early childhood education center, and the Seminole Nation will use its award to create a tribal veterans affairs department. The facility would provide a central location for Native veterans to access services. The Citizen Potawatomi Nation will provide small business loans to at least 10 Native-owned businesses, and the Quapaw Tribe will build a meat processing plant in northeast Oklahoma. For National Native News, I'm Brian Hardzinski in Norman, Oklahoma.
In the New Mexico legislature, the Senate Indian Affairs Committee passed a Senate joint memorial Monday to encourage the state to officially ask the federal government to provide funding and support for a Navajo Kotoker Museum. The proposed project in the community of Sabinito would provide a learning environment and serve as a community center for veterans to gather and access services. The committee also passed a memorial to enhance protections of cultural items. It asks the New Mexico Attorney General and the state's Cultural Affairs Department to work with tribal and community leaders to review laws and make recommendations to help prevent the theft and wrongful sale of items, especially on the internet and at auctions. The Atlanta Dream recently honored the Red Lake Nation's girls' high school basketball team. The Lady Warriors were picked for the Addy Award, presented weekly during the WNBA offseason to a team which exhibits exceptional performance on and off the court. The Minnesota team's current record is 17-6, and in the classroom, the team has a combined 3.0 average, while outside of school, members help with community events. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. For 45 years, NARF has stood firm for justice in Indian country on critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at NARF.org and join the fight for Native rights. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juneau Afternoon here at listener-supported public media, KTOR, KRNN, and Juneau. Our first guests in the studio are Lisa Earhart, Joy Lyon, and Margaret Bauer, here to talk about child care and developments and thread and all sorts of good stuff today. Thanks for coming down the station.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having us.
So, Lisa, you're a professional development person. I want to talk a little bit about the business of caring.
Okay, so the business of caring is an opportunity for new care providers to come and visit with us and learn about the opportunity to get a comprehensive look at starting your own care business. And just so happens, Jeff, this Thursday from 12 to 1 at the Juneau Empire second floor, the AEYC and Threaded Services Training Center will be offering a really great look at all the incentives and opportunities for starting your own caring for business, which is an in-home child care or child care center. So Nikki Love will be hosting that, and she will be able to give you a really great look on costs. And is it a good fit for you? Is it a profession that you would really thrive in? And she gives you a full hour, a couple little bits of snacks and drinks to go with it, and take a look at early child care and the care, a business of caring for young children and people looking at that business. We desperately need to get new providers in our community for our workforce families. So
it's hard enough starting a business, but then including young people and their parents.
Right.
Is there any secret to it?
Well, I think the best part of getting in there is just knowing that that's what you want to do, is work with children and families. And a part of that is the business, but also with Thread Services, we offer all opportunities for training. So we have several opportunities that you can get online, you can come face-to-face, we can give you all the care, all the education you need for working with children, birth zero to eight. And by coming to Thread Services and AEYC, we can make sure that you are giving quality care to children that you work with. We also can promote you getting your CDA credential, which would be really helpful in really harnessing and embracing what is early childhood education with an educational background.
So, define Thread for me, please.
Yep. So Thread is a statewide network of child care resource and referral organizations that work together across the state to help parents find child care and to help make child care more affordable and accessible and higher quality. So we work with the programs themselves to lift the quality and in provide training for the early educators. And then for parents, there's a new search tool that's really exciting. You can just go to threadalaska.org and type in your community that you live in. It's all over the state. And you can see really easily where the different child care programs are. And then there's a drop down that you can click on the name of the program, and up comes everything about them, you know, what their rates are and what ages they serve. You know, do they go on field trips? There's just a great information there. And then people can call the Thread 1-800 number as well to find out more about the programs and if they have openings. And so that's a wonderful thing about Thread. And Thread really, you know, also provides lots of incentives for new programs. Like there's a $1,000 mini grant for new programs that are starting up, as well as up to $1,500 a year to reimburse people for college classes or training in child development. So all those supports, they can come and find out about at the Business of Caring, because it's really a lot of support that we can offer through our partnership with Thread. And then also in our city, we have one of the best programs in the state, I think, with the City and Borough of Juneau support Hearts for Kids. Its initiative, it stands for Hiring, Educating, and Retaining Teaching Staff. And it's all about increasing recruitment and retention of people in child care. So it offers up to over $5,000 a year in an education award if a teacher has their bachelor's degree or master's degree with at least 12 credits in early childhood. And it offers, for someone with an AA, $2,800 a year, or someone with a child development associate credential, which is the equivalent of about 12 credits, it's $850 a year. So that kind of bridges the gap a little bit in terms of one of the really issues in child care is that the wages are so low. I mean, parents are paying an astronomical amount for child care, but because you need a really high number of adults per child when the children are so young, you know, that's the main cost of the program. Where in the school, K through 12, you might have one teacher for 25 children or more. And so for young children, though, the ratio is often to 1 to 4 for infants, or 1 to 6 for toddlers, or 1 to 8 or 10 for preschool. So the salaries are really too much for the program to afford without some kind of help. And that's the other thing that THREAD does, is work with employers and work with, you know, building support for the child care sector. And in light of that, they just released the McDowell Economic Impact Study on Early Care and Learning in Alaska. And there's some really interesting stuff in here. It's like, we didn't know that 15% of the Alaska workforce relies on early care and learning services in order to get to work. So it's a huge economic driver in Juneau and across the state to have child care, because it's kind of like three layers of economic development at once, as Jim Calvin from the McDowell Group explained it to me, that, you know, first you have the parents who are able to go to work, and that's like a $2 billion, you know, impact to the economy in Alaska. Then you've got the 6,700 people working in the field of child care in early care and learning, and they're able to contribute back to the economy, and so that builds the economy. And then kind of the biggest thing that's a little bit hidden is that the high-quality program then builds a stronger workforce in the future. So when children grow up and they have a lot of support and they have a really good quality early learning experience, they're able to turn around and grow up into really solid citizens that have all the skills that employers are looking for. So, and it saves money in the long run for our economy. So when we looked at the economic impact study also, there's, you know, it looks at, well, parents are paying the bulk of child care. And then there's a little bit, you know, from the federal government, and the state government puts in a little bit. And what's really missing is local government and the private sector, the employer support, you know, that could be, because there are really a lot of benefits for employers. So I was excited that we have Margaret Bauer here today, and she just happened to be in town. So because the very first employer-sponsored program in the state was Providence Hospital. And so Margaret is the work-life director of Providence, and it was just a great opportunity to share with employers in Juneau what the benefits are.
Margaret.
All right. Well, I'm happy to be here today in Juneau, and our Center for Child Development this year will celebrate its 32nd year of service to our caregivers and our employees in Anchorage. And we are a nationally accredited program. We're a licensed program, and we serve full and part-time day slots according to the needs of our healthcare workers. We've looked at retention within our child development center of our families. So we have about 120 slots a day. We have about 140 children enrolled. And we look at about a 7% or less turnover for those children who start in our program at an early age. So they might not get in at the infant stage, but they might start as a toddler, and then they go all the way through our preschool program until they enter kindergarten. With that, they lots of times a family will have a second child, and so that employee or caregiver, as we call them at Providence, stays with us for at least 7 to 8 years as an employee, and that's huge as far as retention. Turnover in healthcare is about 17.2%, I think, in 2015, and so that 7% or less helps Providence with their employee turnover. So we're proud of that and our high-quality care.
It's good to hear generically how well a program is doing, but when you put dollars and cents by them, it's amazing.
Yeah, because the cost of recruiting new people and training them is really high. So if you can keep the qualified people you have, which is also an issue with the, that's been addressed in early childhood programs with the HEARTS initiative, is that it's been hugely successful in both increasing the qualifications of the child care teachers. Used to be, before the HEARTS initiative started in 2012, only 1 in 7 child care teachers met the minimum qualifications to be left, you know, in charge of the program. And now it's 1 in 4. So that's a huge gain. And then the teachers are staying longer. We almost had 100% turnover rate in child care teachers before the HEARTS initiative. And now it's down to around 25%, which is still a little bit higher than the healthcare field, right? But it's still, that helps stabilize the care for children, which is, it's for the impact on the child's learning, they really rely on a relationship with the teachers. And the younger the child, the more important that relationship is. So when you have this turnover, it's really hard on children.
Especially in child care. And I was going to say, at the Center for Child Development, we have about 32 staff, full and part-time. But this year, we're going to celebrate 8 of them with 26 to 32 years of service. And 15 with 5-plus years. I just kind of calculated that. So, and the other thing that I think is important and the why we retain them is because they receive the same benefit package as the rest of the healthcare organization. So that's pretty huge because in our industry, we don't often see the benefits provided to those early child care workers.
So we have 2 employer-sponsored programs in Juneau, which is a great start, and they're both doing really well. The Gold Creek Child Development Center in the federal building offers care for federal workers and Coast Guard. And then we just had a tour this afternoon of the Discovery Preschool, which is dedicates priority enrollment for the state especially the legislative staff and state workers in general. So that has huge benefits to those sectors of our economy, and there's a lot of opportunity out there for employers to consider, going in and creating a pool of employers that each subsidize a certain number of spots for their employees, or we're really ready to work with employers as well. So
you mentioned there are 2 openings here, 2 programs in Juneau. Mm-hmm. What does it look like statewide?
Well, Margaret, you could probably speak to that better with...
I'm thinking in Anchorage, besides our military, I think we have about 3 or 4. I know BP has a program. The feds have a contracted program. Providence has theirs. So at least 3 that I can think of.
Credit Union 1.
Credit Union 1 also. I don't know how I could forget that because we help manage their program. And they actually help all their employees statewide. If their employees use a licensed facility, they'll help pay for part of that care.
Well, you certainly know everything about child care services available in the statewide as well as locally here in Juneau.
Yeah.
Anything anybody wants to bring up before we...
I just wanted to mention that we also have our monthly online calendar, and you can find that at threadalaska.org, and that can give you all your training opportunities throughout the state as well as here in Juneau.
And we do have a conference coming up, too. AUIC hosts the annual conference, and it's coming up. It's Resilience, the Power of Relationships. And it's March 18th and 19th here at Centennial Hall. And that's for all early educators, social service providers, teachers, parents, everyone. It's going to have something for everyone there. So it's going to be great.
Lisa Earhart, Joyline, and Margaret Bauer, thank you so much for coming tonight.
Thank you.
And thank you. And please come by our office, call us, or email us, and let us help you with your professional development.
What's your phone number again?
789-1235.
And an email address?
We'll do threadalaska.org, one word, and that can get you to your training opportunities. And it also will connect you to our AEYC -SEA.org, and that's the AEYC office.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 16th of February, 2016. It's the birthday of the printer Giambattista Bodoni, born in Saluzzo, Italy, 1740, who designed almost 300 typefaces, and his typeface Bodoni, still available on almost any word processing program. It's the birthday of Henry Adams, Boston, 1838, the grandson of John Quincy Adams. He decided he did not want to go into politics, instead became a political journalist and a historian, and then wrote his autobiography, The Education of Henry Adams. It was on this day in the year 600, Pope Gregory the Great declared, "God bless you," to be the correct thing you should say after someone sneezes. It was thought that sneezing was an omen of death. The plague was at its height in Europe, and as the plague spread across Europe, this idea of saying, "God bless you," when people sneeze, spread. It survived to this day. It's the birthday of a novelist who said, "For me to do well at anything, I have to work harder than other people." That was Richard Ford, born in Jackson, Mississippi, 1944. His father was a traveling salesman. Father died of a heart attack when the boy was 16. Ford was sent to live with his grandparents, who ran a hotel in Arkansas. He went off to Michigan State to study hotel administration, spent a semester doing that, then switched to literature. He said, "When I read Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom, the first novel I ever read, it just took me over. It left me with a reverence for literature which does not require an encyclopedic knowledge. I read what I read really closely. People always know more than I do, but what I know, I know." He was 34 when he published his first novel, A Piece of My Heart. He wrote a few novels that did not sell all that well, and so his wife Christina suggested that he try writing about someone who was happy for a change, and he came up with a sports writer named Frank Bascom. Richard Ford had been a sports writer, so he created Frank Bascom, living in New Jersey. He wrote The Sports Writer. It was a big success in 1986, followed by Independence Day, The Lay of the Land, and Let Me Be Frank with You. Richard Ford, who said, "I believe that a piece of imaginative work is better when it bears the least resemblance to its maker." Here's a poem for today by Jack Gilbert, The Danger of Wisdom. "We learn to live without passion, to be reasonable. We go hungry amid the giant granaries this world is. We store up plenty for when we are old and mild. It is our strength that deprives us." Like Keats, listening to the doctor who said the best thing for tuberculosis was to eat only one slice of bread and a fragment of fish each day. Keats starved himself to death because he yearned so desperately to feast on Fanny Brawn. Emerson and his wife decided to make love sparingly in order to accumulate his passion. We are taught to be moderate, to live intelligently. A poem by Jack Gilbert, The Danger of Wisdom, from The Dance Most of All, published by Knopf and used by permission here in the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, brain training developed by scientists to challenge memory and problem-solving through online games, Lumosity.com. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Mondays are back at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center, now open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m., Saturdays 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., and Sundays noon until 6 p.m. Schedules are available online at juno.org/parkrec/diamondpark. For more information, call Diamond Park Aquatic Center at 586-2782.
It's about 25 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to a Juno afternoon. My next guests are Saul Neely and Scott Burney to talk about the Flying University Forum. Thanks for coming to the station.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having us on the show.
So for people who do not know, and I imagine that's a number of people out there, what exactly is the Flying University?
I'll let Saul take that one.
The Flying University is a prison education program that I started in fall 2012 that brings UAS students into Lemon Creek Correctional Center for mutual and collaborative study. It's modeled off the Inside Out Prison Exchange Program, which started at a Temple University and now has it's been modeled in University of Oregon. So University of Oregon does a lot of work with the Inside Out Prison Exchange Program. We modeled that, adapted it a little bit with some other prison education influences that I had an opportunity to witness. Because we're such a small community here in Juneau, once some of the inmates began to get out of Lemon Creek, they continued their studies at UAS. And so what makes Flying University unique in the nation is that it's not just a prison education program, but now it's a reentry effort as well.
What classes did they take?
Inside the prison, mostly I teach philosophy and literature classes. Last semester I did Shakespeare, which is really fun because I also taught Shakespeare at UAS. This semester we just started up our spring semester last Friday, and we're doing ethics as first philosophy, and we're actually looking at prison reform movements and how we can reconceptualize justice and, in the end, abolish the prison system as we know it.
I ask this because I know you're going to give me a good answer. Well, what's so important about it?
Well, we have such a huge broken system right now. United States has 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners. The trauma that is prison, the prison system doesn't really rehabilitate. It actually produces a great deal of delinquency, and it produces recidivism. It's a failed system, and so it's important that we intervene against it and bring education and other opportunities to restore these people's lives.
What was it like working with prison officials?
It was good. We enjoy a lot of support with the prison administration at Lemon Creek and also UAS administration. Superintendent Busby is a real wonderful guy to work with. He supports the Flying University. Dave Wilson, inside one of the main parole officers, he's a big ally. We have allies outside of the prison here with the at the parole office. So it's been really nice. I think the two biggest allies we have are Chris Weichselman and Paul McCarthy, the two education coordinators inside Lemon Creek, and they have spent a lot of time helping us build Flying University and make it a success.
But how many students do you have?
This semester we have a lot. It's kind of crazy. We have 16 inside students, so we call them inside students and outside students. So the folks who are incarcerated are inside students. We have 16 inside students right now, and that's balanced against 11 outside students. Typically, we try to match them one for one, and the ideal situation is when we have 9 inside students to 9 outside students. It gives us a nice balance of 18 in the classroom, and it's good.
What was the reaction from the inmates, and now added a change over the years?
Some folks in Lemon Creek are serving very long sentences, and so we do have a handful of guys who have been doing Flying University since the first semester. And they help me shape it and direct it. We do have what we call a Flying University think tank inside the prison. So between semesters, I go in and I will meet with Paul McCarthy and 3 or 4 of the guys who are serving long sentences, and they've been with us from the beginning. I like to make sure that everything we're doing with the Flying University is measured and meaningful with the guys inside. So I'm really grateful for that think tank opportunity. One of the things that has changed is that it's become much more seminar oriented. So this is something I learned when I went into Riverbend Maximum Security Prison in Nashville. I was there for a Rethinking Prisons conference, and was invited to go into this maximum security prison, and I saw the way they organized their classes. And they do the breakout discussions, which is really great. So we have 18 people in the large group, then we break up into groups of 4 or 5. We have our intense 20-minute seminar conversations, then we reconvene into the larger group and report back. It's a really great way of organizing the seminar discussion. And I think the other major development is the guys run the agenda now. So when we show up, university students and I show up to the prison, we get inside the classroom, and one of the inmates picks up the agenda and guides us and directs us. So,
where did the term flying university come from?
Well, one of my teachers, Martin Matustic, was born in Prague. And when the Soviets invaded in 1968, he was studying with Jan Patochka and Václav Havel. They had a secret philosophy class, a secret underground philosophy school, and they called their enterprise the Flying University. Matustic ended up fleeing to the United States after the Flying University was raided by the secret police. Patochka died of his interrogation wound, so he died a Socratic death at the hands of the state for corrupting the youth. And I studied with Matustic both in Prague and at Purdue University, where I did my PhD. Matustic actually came up here for the first Spring Honor Symposium and went inside the prison and met the guys. We were reading Havel, we were reading some of Matustic's own work, and it was just a wonderful day in the prison. And the guys collectively decided we wanted to name what we're doing the Flying University in sort of remembrance of this earlier Flying University.
This Thursday, there's a forum going on down at 360 Studios. You want to tell me more about the program, Scott?
I will. So this Thursday, doors open at 6 p.m. downstairs at 360. It's free. And at 6:30, we're going to start the short documentary. It takes about 22 minutes to watch. And we got to go in with video cameras to Lemon Creek and check out the Flying University inside. And we have interviews with people who are inside, participants in the class, folks who have gotten out and are now part of Flying University at UAS. Is that how you
mm-hmm. yep.
say it, Saul? And so it just takes a pretty close look at what goes on, what Saul's been talking about inside the university, and reemphasizes the origins that Saul was just talking about, but also asks some interesting questions, and it looks at the justice system in general and addresses reentry and the need for community involvement. So I'm really happy with how it came out. David Purdy, 360 North, and KTOO Web and camera guy extraordinaire and director, producer, we got to work together to do this. So we're gonna screen the film at 6:30 and then reset the room a little bit, and at 7 we're going to start a forum. And the forum will go for about an hour, and we are hoping that a lot of folks from the community will come who are interested in this, and we'll be speaking with people from the film and other experts in the community about education in prison, successful reentry, reducing recidivism, justice reform, and we'll see what else comes up. And we hope folks will participate. There will be time for audience participation.
And you brought a sample with you. Could you leave in for us, please?
Yeah, so this is Marcos Galindo, and this is one of my favorite cuts from the film. We're sitting out at UAS. He's a student who is a Flying University student who started inside and has now he got out of prison, and he is taking classes at the University of Alaska Southeast with Saul and other professors out there. And go ahead and run it.
Things were going good. You know, somebody called me a wetback, and I beat the brakes off of him, which now I know, because I could think critically, that that's not the way you approach racism. So I wish I'd known that then. But it sent me on the path, right? I got to meet Saul, right? So not only I would have been in school, but it would have been a lot harder, right? Saul put this whole thing in motion. This whole Flying University thing wouldn't exist without Saul, right? It wouldn't, none of this would have existed without Saul, because he paved this path of a fellowship, through education, right? It's not based on anything. It's based on education. Like, hey, we're going to read some cool stuff, and we're going to talk about it. So if it probably wasn't without him, I'd probably be selling heroin. I'll be honest with you. I'd probably be coming to school and doing bad things and try to come to school, go back to prison, go back to California, doing life, probably dead, who knows. A lot of bad things, evilness, if it wasn't for the fine university.
As a sample about this Thursday night's program, it starts at what time again, Scott?
The movie starts at, or the documentary starts at 6:30, and the forum starts at 7. Admission is free. It's all downstairs.
So what impressed you most about your experiences with the program so far?
What impresses me the most is the irrepressible attitude of a lot of the guys in there. There's a lot of just bad energy and other things that go on in the prison system. But when we get into the classroom, it's almost a utopian space inside the prison. We can talk to each other as human beings. We can treat each other as incommensurable with our histories and our pasts and try to build an alternative for the future. So,
cool. Scott, remind us one more time of the times and dates for the program.
Sure. So it's this Thursday. Doors open at 6. The mini documentary, the short documentary, starts at 6:30. And then the forum starts at 7. About that night, I think we'll be posting that also on 360north.org. And shortly thereafter, it will start broadcasting on 360 North TV statewide. Both the documentary and the forum, they'll often run as companion pieces. So,
all right. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
I don't think so.
I hope folks come out. It'll be great to have some community participation because it sounds like community is the solution to a lot of these problems.
Yes, that's true.
About 20 minutes before the hour, and you are tuned into Juneau Afternoon here on listener-supported KTO and KRNN-FM in Juneau. Our next guests in the studio are Beth Weigel and Andy Hershey to talk about various activities going on in the library.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff, for giving us another chance to tell everybody about all the things happening at the library this month.
We got a lot of stuff.
Yeah, so this week we'll have our preschool family night on Thursday out at the Valley, which is co-sponsored by the Association for the Education of Young Children. And all of our family nights, the ones at the Valley as well as downtown, we have a light supper that starts at 5:30, and then we'll have our program. There's usually a craft involved. And this week's program is friendships, and Kathy Fanning will be there to do some songs and tell some stories about friendships. And then on Friday, February 19th, we'll be doing the Day of Remembrance out at the Valley Library, and it'll be all focused around the empty chair display and a program that will be in conjunction with the Juneau Douglas City Museum. So that'll be 5:30 on Friday, and this is, of course, one of the anniversaries of the executive order that Roosevelt made in 1942, which basically, you know, Japanese people in internment during that period. And so the different events that will be going on with this program that starts at 5:30, Greg Cheney's film, Empty Chair, will be shown again. He's reworked it a little bit, so, you know, it's about 50 minutes, and he's getting a lot of really good response. He's also talking and showing the film in San Francisco and Seattle, as well as here as part of this year's Day of Remembrance, which is a national event. And we'll have some refreshments, and then there'll be a talk. Margie Hamburger will show some slides and talk a little bit about the different things that happened during that period of the internment during right after Pearl Harbor, of course. So that happens on Friday. And then another event happening through the museum, Coffee and Collections, is on Saturday at the museum. That's also in conjunction with the Canvas Art Studio. Avery Skaggs will be there, and there'll be some talking about his life as an artist and some of the process that people work through to be artists. And it'll be, I think, an interesting discussion. Next week, we're going to have Dark Winter Nights. It's a storytelling. It's going to be actually a statewide storytelling. So if you're a big fan of mudrooms, I think this will be something that people will be interested in. Up in Fairbanks, their equivalent of mudrooms is called Dark Winter Nights. And Rob had the idea up there in Fairbanks to do a statewide storytelling event using our Online with Libraries, our OWL video conferencing system. So there's six libraries involved in this. Fairbanks is the host. And then Kodiak, Valdez, Kenai, Unalaska, and Juneau are all going to connect up with Fairbanks via the OWL system. And the idea is that we'll share real Alaskan stories, true Alaskan stories, amazing adventures. So I've got a few people that have called up and asked about being participants, and we may need a few more participants. It's a little bit of an open mic format as well. So people interested in telling a 5 or 10 minute real Alaskan story that happened to you can give me a call at the library, and that'll be on Thursday next week on the 25th at the downtown library starting at 6.
So will there be storytellers around the state?
Yeah, so there'll be storytellers around the state. So we'll hopefully have a nice little cozy audience in our large meeting room. That's where our OWL programming equipment is located. And then we'll have probably enough time for 3, maybe 4 storytellers. But certainly anybody who's interested, come prepared, because if some of the other locations don't have people that are ready to participate, we probably will be able to provide more stories from here. But it's a 2-hour event, so, you know, I think each library will probably have 3-4 storytellers, and I think it'll be really interesting to hear some of the stories from other parts of the state as well as participating. So we'll look forward to having a nice cozy audience as well.
A couple of years ago, we broadcast one of the Dark Winter Nights programs.
Yeah.
And it was a Dark Winter's Night.
Yeah. So although the days are getting a little longer, I think it'll probably be dark by 6 p.m. So it'll be a fun thing, I think, to share on Thursday next week, the 25th, at the Downtown Library. And then on Friday, we have our Science Friday at the library. We're doing the Science of Accessibility, and that's at the Valley from 1 to 3 on the 26th. That's a day off from school. So we'll have our friends from ORCA and SAIL there to talk a little bit about some of the equipment that people use, people who experience disabilities use to get accessibility. And our friend Corey Gilmore will be there. He's an artist and activist, accessibility activist. He'll talk about his experiences. And that'll be a really good time, I think, an interesting time. We're also going to, a little bit later at 3:30, show The Elephant Man, which probably has a little bit maybe older audience interest, you know, more of the upper ages, PG-13. So, but for our Science Friday, it's, you know, any kids from probably age 7 to 15, and then, like I said, Elephant Man, which we just did as a Science on Screen film and had Robin Walls talk about, will be at 3:30 in the library. So those are some of the events that we've got going on. I know that's involving the youth. Andy has a few things, too, that are also coming up the rest of the month as well as starting in March.
Yeah, so we have a bunch of different classes that are available at the library now, thanks to partnerships. So one of the first ones we're doing is we're having a class called Starting a Cottage Food Business, and it's going to be Sarah Lewis from UIF Cooperative Extension. sorry. And she is going to be talking about how to get started on a business if you want to be in the food industry, but in a small scale way. So that's going to be at the Douglas Library on Saturday, February 27th. It starts at 1:30, and Sarah's amazing, so everybody should go. And then we're partnering with the Learning Connection to offer two different types of classes out at the Valley. So on Wednesday nights, starting, you know, just right now, and it goes for the next 6 weeks, we're doing English classes. So if English isn't your first language, you can come on by and have a really great instructor and talk with other people. And we practice reading and writing and speaking and listening. And so that's every Wednesday night, 5:30 to 7 at the Valley Library for the next 6 weeks. And then starting the first week in March, we are going to be doing adult education classes. So if you don't have your GED or you're working towards it, or you want just more practice in math or writing or reading or social studies, there will be an instructor at the Valley Library on Thursdays, 5:30 to 7 p.m. And that runs all of March, all of April. You can come to one class. You can come to all of the classes. We hope people will register in advance, because then you could tell us what you need help with. Do you need more math help, or are you more interested in social studies help or writing? And then we can kind of prepare in advance what to present the classes. But it's going to be, it's a great opportunity. So if you are working on your GED or you're thinking about getting your GED, I think you should come to the Valley Library Thursdays, 5:30, and it starts in March.
Yeah, and another thing on the museum front as well, the Judo Douglas Museum, just to kick off March as well, they're going to be doing their 12x12 display. So they're looking for calls right now, putting out a call to bring in your 12x12 art. And the theme is Let's Get Emotional. Basically, it just has to be 12x12 inches, and it has to be ready to hang. So anybody can be part of that exhibit. And it's a fun display, I think. Lots of really creative things people put together for that. And ongoing at the museum also is the USS Juno Silver display, which will be here for a while, but they just had the reception. And just a reminder to people that that's a really great opportunity to go to the museum right now. It's free. Different people sponsor the months in the off-tour season so that Juno community can come in and check out things for free. So that's a great time. And then also, just whenever you're looking for information about the library, you can check our website at juno.org/library or on our Facebook page. And we'll encourage you to check in next week, midweek or so. We've got some exciting information we'll be sharing with the public, and I'll leave it at that.
You can't do that.
It's a teaser. Gotta come and check it out.
Beth Wagle and Beth Wagle and Andy Hirsch, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thank you.
I love it when you read to me, read to me, read to me. I love it when you read to me, please read to me some more. Story about a kid like me.
Chenille Sisters. It's about 9 minutes before the hour. You are tuned in to a Juno Afternoon. Our next guest is Brent Edwards, who's the principal at Gassner School. And Ezekiel and Mahala, thank you so much for coming down the station today.
Good afternoon.
So tell me about the process, project you're working on. It's a big glass mosaic.
Yeah, it's really fun. And there's an artist named Marianne Manning, and she's lived here for a few years, and she's working on it with us and helping us.
What does it look like?
It's really beautiful, and there's some fireweed, and there's three eagles, there's a glacier, and lots of trees.
How big is it?
I'm thinking it's like 10 feet long.
Pretty big.
Yeah, there are actually three panels that will be hung separately, and they're about 4 feet by, I don't know, maybe 6 feet is the biggest. So they're pretty large.
And they're going to go at Gassner School?
Yeah, we had a fun time trying to find a great location for them because they're absolutely beautiful, and they're going to be hung in the commons area right when you walk into the school.
So tell me what it was like working on the mosaic itself.
Difficult. It takes a long time to make something so big, but all the kids in Gastineau helped work on it. And that's why I think it's going to last a long time.
What was the most fun part about it for you?
The most fun part is to put it together.
Did you make the design that before you started working with the glass?
Yeah.
Well, what's the process? How many, you say all the kids at school had a hand in this?
Yeah, it's been a couple weeks project. We started out with the original concept, kind of the design. We wanted to obviously choose something that was locally inspired. We chose the Mendenhall Glacier with lots of trees, and we really wanted to highlight the pink of the fireweed that ended up being really neat. And we also put in some eagles because we're the Gastineau Eagles. So we started off with the design, and then building the actual panels was done by the maintenance department of the Juneau School District. And then the Marianne started doing some rough painting and sketching on the plywood that the students ended up putting the glass pieces on. All the pieces were broken by the students. So as a principal of the school, you can imagine I was a little nervous watching all of our students break glass and work with broken glass, but it ended up being an amazing experience for the kids and really fun to watch the progression of the entire project.
And how long have you been working on this?
Was it been three weeks?
3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I am in Miss Stanek's class, and we had 6 times working on it for about an hour.
Was it fun?
It was fun. And 4 students got to work extra on the mosaic. It was me, Ezekiel, Ani, and Jessica. And we helped make the eagles, and it was really fun.
Were you worried about cutting yourself?
I cut myself a little bit, but it wasn't really bad.
That's cool. So now that you've had this experience doing mosaics, is that something you want to do later on in your life?
Yeah. Probably in the future or the next year.
I think it'd be really fun to do another mosaic.
Is that in the works, principal?
I think the great thing about the artist in the school project is, especially this year, the entire school was able to participate. Some years it's just the 3rd through 5th, and some years it's just the kindergarten through 2nd grade. So this project was special because it was the entire school. The other neat thing about the artists in the school projects is that you can go to any of the schools in our school district and ask someone which projects or which art that's hanging in the schools was part of it, because all of the schools participate. We want to give a shout out to our parent group who helped fund the project to make it all possible for us to do.
How big were the individual pieces of glass?
About the size of a dime, or a little bigger or a little smaller.
So how many pieces of glass do you think you worked with?
I don't know. I just know it's a lot.
And when is it going to be all complete?
I think it's about complete. The next step would be to have it hung. We have an annual art show at Gastineau in May, and I believe we're going to do some kind of celebration or, you know, official unveiling of the project in May. But it will be hung before then.
Where is it going to be physically inside the school?
It's in the commons area. Right when you walk into the school, you can see it right when you walk through the front doors.
So if a member of the general public wants to come and look at this, they need to stop by the office and check in.
Yes, please. Check in at the front desk, stick on a visitor badge, and you are welcome to come in and take a look.
What was the hardest thing about putting this mosaic together?
Probably finding the right-sized pieces to fit in the holes and making the eagle, because some pieces were a little bit bigger, so we had to fit smaller pieces in with the smaller pieces and chop up some big parts sometimes.
Brenda, Ezekiel, and Mahala, thank you so much for coming by the station.
Thank you so much for having us here today.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you.
This is Bird Note. Sand grouse, pointy-tailed relatives of pigeons, live in some of the most parched environments on Earth. To satisfy the thirst of newly hatched chicks, male sand grouse bring water back to the nest by carrying it in their feathers. It sounds incredible, and for decades, scientists thought it was just a myth, but it's not. In the cool of the desert morning, the male flies up to 20 miles to a shallow water hole, then wades in up to his belly. The water is collected by rocking. The bird shifts its body side to side and repeatedly shakes the belly feathers in the water. Fill-up can take as long as 15 minutes. Thanks to coiled, hair-like extensions on the feathers of the underparts, a sand grouse can soak up and transport 25 milliliters of liquid. That's close to 2 tablespoons. Once the male has flown back across the desert with his life-giving cargo, the sand grouse chicks crowd around him and use their bills like tiny squeegees, milking their father's belly feathers for water they so desperately need. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas.